and that's bicycles. With so many bikes, traffic congestion and pollution are reduced, parked cars don't clog the streets, and people are in good shape. By the way, what's safe for the environment can be dangerous for absent-minded pedestrians. On my last visit to Copenhagen, on two occasions, I was nearly flattened as I stepped from a taxi into the bike lane. London and Paris have taken lanes away from car drivers to create bike lanes, but so far the lanes are underused and the entire effort just seems to make things worse. Somehow, Copenhagen has figured it out. During Copenhagen's rush hour, rain or shine, there are more bikes on the roads than cars, and everything moves smoothly. While walking through one of Copenhagen's main squares, I noticed it was dominated by people, couples, and buildings. It felt calm, spacious, and inviting. I looked again and saw that there were also about 50 parked bikes, blending into the scene almost unnoticed, and absolutely no cars. If instead of bikes those were parked cars, the charm would be replaced by chaos and noisy congestion. Many hotels even provide their guests with loaner or rental bikes. I find having a bike parked in my hotel's bike rack is a great way to fit in and literally go local. Copenhagen has as many bike lanes as car lanes, and I can get anywhere in the town center as fast on my two wheels as by taxi. When you get out of the city and explore the Danish countryside, you'll see that newly paved roads are lined by perfectly smooth bike lanes, one for each direction. Even out in the country, it seems that bikes outnumber cars. An interview with a Copenhagener. For insight on the Danish way of life, I talked to Richard Karpen, a friend and tour guide who leads tours around his city, educating visitors both about Denmark's history and its current social reality. Richard, a longtime resident of Copenhagen, calls himself a social historian. He agreed to chat with me about the issues in this chapter. Here are a few highlights of our conversation. Denmark is famous for being happy. I asked Richard, "Why exactly are you Danes so darn happy?" Richard responded this way. "Danish values are human values. Three important elements are trust, the freedom to be yourself, and finding purpose in life." I think in America, trust is a big issue these days. Well, we Danes are a trusting and trustworthy people. In Denmark, social trust, that's a general feeling that you trust your fellow citizens and the pillar institutions of your government, law courts, police, hospitals, and so on, is generally found to be the highest in the world. A perfect example of our Danish social trust is the image of babies sleeping in carriages outside a restaurant while the parents eat inside. You might say, "But no one's watching." We Danes will say, "Everybody's watching." If anyone accidentally leaves a wallet, purse, or backpack in a cafe, and a Dane finds it, it'll be returned with the money, credit cards, and passport intact. You can throw a found wallet in any post box, and the post office will return it to the owner. If someone tips over in the bicycle lane, Danes will stop to help the person, call an ambulance, and wait until the ambulance arrives. Most of us Danes feel we're able to find purpose in life. In fact, Danes share a collective purpose, forming a cohesive and effective society. Sure, we Danes pay some of the highest taxes in the world, and 7 out of 10 in a recent survey said they'd be willing to pay even more in order to keep the system functioning to protect the most vulnerable in our society. They feel individually responsible and committed to social welfare. They're connected to something bigger than any individual. This gives them a sense of purpose and helps them feel contented in life. They are not victims of the system. They're part of it. In Denmark, people have the freedom to be themselves. Danes feel that the main purpose of education is to develop the personality of the child. We Danes teach our children that no matter what they're good at, they're making a contribution to society. You're not a lesser human being because you struggle with math or science. You can be the best in your class in creativity or cooking. This gives our Danish children an extraordinary base in choosing a life that corresponds to who they are. According to the Social Progress Index, Denmark ranks as number one out of 128 countries surveyed because we're considered best at addressing the basic human needs of life, equipping citizens to improve the quality of their lives, protecting the environment, and providing opportunities for everyone to make personal choices and reach their full potential. Denmark also happens to be a wealthy nation, but wealth is a poor estimator of happiness. The GDP per capita in the United States is $10,000 higher than here in Denmark, but the U.S. ranks a distant 13th in the global study of happiness and well-being. Denmark is one of the Scandinavian countries, along with Norway and Sweden. I asked Richard to tell me about the Scandinavian model and why it works. Richard responded this way. Here in Scandinavia, our countries score high on any list of economic and life quality indicators. The success of our so-called Scandinavian model is commonly attributed to several factors: income equality, a high level of trust, a high willingness to pay tax, which is tightly coupled with strong social security, a blend of governmental regulations and capitalism, and cultural homogeneity. An American might scoff at what they see as an overly regulated, overly taxed, and overly restrictive society. We Danes might point out that the USA is called the land of the free and the land of opportunity. But is freedom staying at a job you hate because you don't want to lose your health insurance? Is independence putting your career on hold and relying on your spouse's income so you can take care of a young child when your employer doesn't offer paid parental leave or daycare is too expensive? Does opportunity mean depending on the resources of your parents or a bundle of loans to get a university degree? Is realizing the American dream supposed to be so stressful? From our Danish perspective, you could make a case that the notion of the United States as a land of freedom and opportunity is trailing behind reality. The choices Scandinavian countries have made in arranging our society over the last 30 years have ended up bringing people a lot more freedom and a lot more equality of opportunity. For example, in America, gender roles are more traditional than in Scandinavian countries. This is partly because of the way a society supports or doesn't support families. American women often become much more dependent on their husbands once they have children. That's because they're more likely to put aside their career to care for the kids. In Scandinavian countries, society generally provides support for women and men to work and take care of their families together, and for children to be able to rise above their parents' educational levels or income levels. This is, ironically, traditionally what the American dream has been about. There's an interesting happiness gap in families. In America, many people who don't have children tend to be happier and less stressed out financially than people who do. But in Scandinavian countries, people who have children are happier than those who don't. Why is this? It boils down to affordable daycare, paid sick days, paid vacation days, and not having to constantly worry about paying for health care and college. That's the Danish version of family values. I asked Richard what he thought is the most misunderstood part of the Scandinavian model among Americans. Richard responded this way. Many Americans think the Scandinavians are socialists. Scandinavians are actually quite capitalistic, but they prioritize in social areas. One of the wonderful things about Americans is they have this huge faith in everyone's ability. It's like, let's go to the moon, and they do. But to me, the curious thing is how Americans lose that faith immediately when they discuss something like affordable daycare. It's like, oh no, if we give this to people, they'll never work again. I told Richard that many Americans might say, this all sounds great, but you guys are paying sky-high taxes. We don't want anything to do with that. Richard responded this way. First of all, the taxes are not necessarily as high as many Americans think. For someone who lives in the U.S., where I understand you have federal taxes, state taxes, city taxes, and property taxes, the cumulative tax burden is not very different than the tax burden here in Denmark. And secondly, to smartly compare relative taxation, you need to consider what you get for your taxes. Americans might pay lower taxes initially, but then, on top of that, you must pay for daycare, health insurance, college tuition, all these things that we Danes get included with our taxes. Finally, on a lighter note, I asked Richard to explain the wonderfully Danish idea of hygge. Richard responded this way. Hygge is an approach to living that encompasses warmth, togetherness, safety, intimacy, peacefulness, simplicity, enjoyment, and contentment. It's about an atmosphere and an experience rather than about things. It's about being with the people we love, the feeling that we are safe, shielded from the world, and that we can let our guard down. Hygge is sitting around a friendly dinner table by the glow of candlelight, a good book, and a cup of tea. It's a winter walk on the beach. It's preparing for a family Christmas. It's baking bread in a warm kitchen. It's cocoa by candlelight. The key is to embrace these experiences fully, live them in the moment, and appreciate that they bring spiritual rewards along with the more tangible benefits of, say, having read a good book. Hygge draws meaning from ordinary living. It's a way of acknowledging the sacred in the secular, of giving something ordinary a special context, a special spirit, a warmth, and taking time to make it extraordinary. For we Danes, hygge is a big part of being Danish. Immigrants, treasure your heritage and melt. I've painted a rosy picture of Denmark, but the country is not without its challenges. One key challenge facing Denmark, along with the rest of Europe and the U.S., is immigration. When my grandparents migrated from Norway to the United States, they lost contact with their Norwegian relatives and had little choice but to melt into American society. And while they arrived speaking barely a word of English, just two generations later, I barely speak a word of Norwegian. Had they immigrated today, they could go online to read Norwegian news, watch television shows from back home, and video chat with relatives around the world. Modern telecommunication advances allow communities of foreigners to settle in more comfortable places while remaining in close contact with far-flung friends and family back in the old country. Like the Algerian family I mentioned in Chapter 3, who've been in the Netherlands for three generations, barely speak a word of Dutch, and are still enthusiastically Algerian, these people have no interest in assimilating. Consequently, rather than melting pots, wealthy countries such as Denmark are becoming cafeteria plates, with dividers keeping ethnic groups separate. Immigration can be a major wedge issue, especially in formerly homogeneous nations. Only 40 years ago, there were virtually no foreigners in Denmark. As in many European countries, part of the population, especially older and more insular Danes, fears immigrants and gravitates to right-wing racist parties. Meanwhile, progressive Danes, who celebrate a multicultural future, wonder why their wealthy nation of high-tech multilingual globalists is still struggling to get along with their relatively small community of Muslim immigrants. While some Danes view their growing Muslim minority as a problem, others are willing to see a more colorful society as an opportunity. At Copenhagen's City Museum, I met a Pakistani Dane who worked there as a guide. He spoke Danish like a local and talked earnestly about the exhibit, as if his own ancestors pioneered the city. Thinking of assimilation, I got emotional. Surprised at being choked up, I was struck by the beauty of a Pakistani Dane, as opposed to a Pakistani living in Denmark. Am I wrong to wish that a Muslim living in Denmark would become a Dane? Am I wrong to wish the United States would speak only English rather than Norwegian or Spanish as well? Am I wrong to lament districts of London that have a disdain for all things British? Immigrants energize the land, but they do it best, as is the story of the United States, when their vision is a healthy melting pot. Melt, immigrants. Treasure your heritage while embracing your adopted homelands. But it's more than just an immigrant issue. Europeans, like Americans, fearful of encroachment, change, and different hues of skin, need to show tolerance, outreach, and understanding. From what I've seen with these attitudes, it works better for all involved. Christiania, Copenhagen's embattled commune. I was strolling through the commotion of downtown Copenhagen, past chain restaurants dressed up to look old and under towering hotels that seemed to sport the name of a different international chain each year. Then, as if from another age, a man pedaled by me with his wife sitting in the utilitarian bucket-like wagon of his three-wheeled Christiania bike. You'd call the couple granola in the United States. Looking as out of place here in Copenhagen as an Amish couple wandering the canyons of Manhattan, they were residents of Christiania. While Denmark sounds wildly innovative in the way it takes socialism to its logical extreme, that system only works as long as the complete society is on board. Everyone obeys the laws so that all can be safe, affluent, and comfortable. And yet, Denmark also hosts Europe's most inspirational and thriving nonconformist hippie commune. Perhaps being content and conformist is easier for a society when its nonconformist segment, rebelling against all that button-down conformity, has a refuge. In 1971, the original 700 Christianians established squatters' rights in an abandoned military barracks just a 10-minute walk from the Danish Parliament building. Two generations later, this free city still stands, an ultra-human communal mishmash of idealists, hippies, potheads, non-materialists, and happy children. The population today? 600 adults, 200 kids, 200 cats, 200 dogs, 17 horses, and a couple of parrots. Seeing seniors with gray ponytails woodworking, tending their gardens, and serving as guardians of the community's ideals, I'm reminded that 180 of the original gang that took over the barracks 4 decades ago still call Christiania home. The Christianians are fighting a rising tide of materialism and conformity in Denmark, and they're determined to raise their children to be free spirits. Everyone knows utopias are utopian. They can't work. But Christiania, which has evolved with the challenges of making a utopia a viable reality, acts like it never got the message. It's broken into 14 administrative neighborhoods on land still owned by Denmark's Ministry of Defense. Locals build their homes, but don't own the land. There's no buying or selling of property. When someone moves out, the community decides who will be invited in to replace that person. A third of the adult population works on the outside, a third works on the inside, and a third doesn't work much at all. For the first few years, hard drugs and junkies were tolerated. But that led to violence and polluted the mellow ambiance that residents envisioned. In 1979, the junkies were expelled, an epic confrontation now embedded in the community's folk history. Since then, the symbol of a fist breaking a syringe is as prevalent as the leafy marijuana icon. Hard drugs are emphatically forbidden in Christiania. But not pot. Marijuana has always been the national plant of the free city. Pusher Street, named for the sale of soft drugs here, is Christiania's main drag. It was once lined with stalls selling marijuana, joints, and hash. But about 15 years ago, Pusher Street came under fire. To preempt city forces from shutting down the entire community for its open sale of pot, residents bulldozed the marijuana stalls lining Pusher Street in 2004. Since then, in spite of regular police raids, marijuana remains prevalent. But the retailing, while still fragrant, is no longer flagrant. On my last visit, I found a small stretch of Pusher Street, dubbed the Green Light District, where pot was openly, if cautiously, being sold. Signs acknowledged that this activity was still illegal and announced 3 rules. 1, have fun. 2, no photos. And 3, no running, because it makes people nervous. The crackdown provided a classic case study in the regrettable consequences of a war on marijuana. For the first time in years, the Copenhagen street price for pot went up. Gangs started moving into the marijuana business, and street crime became associated with marijuana. There was actually a murder in 2005 as pushers fought to establish their turf, almost unthinkable in mellower times. Get beyond the touristy main drag of Christiania, and you'll find a fascinating, ramshackle world of peaceniks, shuffled with some irony among the moats, earthen ramparts, and barracks of the former military base. Alternative housing, carpenter shops, hippie villas, cozy tea houses, children's playgrounds, peaceful lanes, and interfaith stupa-like temples serve people who believe that to be normal is to be in a straitjacket. There are a handful of basic rules along with the prohibition against hard drugs. No cars, no guns, no explosives, and so on. A few luxury hippies have oil heat, but most use wood or gas. The community has one mailing address. A phone chain provides a system of communal security because Christianians have had bad experiences calling the police. As a reminder of the constant police presence lately, my favorite Christiania cafe, the Moonfisher, has a sign outside. It says, "The world's safest cafe. Police raids nearly every day." Meanwhile, an amazing thing has happened. Christiania, famous for its counterculture scene, geodesic domes on its back lanes, and vegetarian cafes, has become one of the most visited sites among tourists in Copenhagen. Move over, Little Mermaid. I recently got an email from some traveling readers. They said, "We're not prudes, but Christiania was creepy. Don't take kids here or visit after dark." I agree, it's not a pretty place. But hanging out with parents raising their children with Christiania values and sharing a meal featuring homegrown vegetables with a couple born and raised in this community, I find a distinct human beauty in the place. And I've come to believe more strongly than ever that it's important to allow this social experiment to survive and to give alternative-type people a place to live out their values. As I biked through Christiania, it also occurred to me that, except for the bottled beer being sold, there was not a hint of any corporate entity in the entire free city. There was no advertising and no big business. Everything was handmade. Nothing was packaged. People consumed as if how they spent their money shaped the environment in which they lived and raised their families. It's not such a far cry from their fellow Danes, who also see themselves as conscientious participants in and shapers of their society. But ever since its inception, Christiania has been a political hot potato. No one in the Danish establishment wanted it, and no one has had the nerve to mash it. While once very popular with the general Copenhagen community, Christianians have lost some goodwill recently as they're seen more as a clique, no longer accepting others to join and looking out only for themselves. Mindful of their need for popular support from their Copenhagen neighbors, Christianians are working to connect better with the rest of society. Its residents now pool their money, creating a fund to pay for utilities and city taxes, about $1 million a year, and an annual budget of another $1 million to run their local affairs. Recently, Denmark's government has tried to normalize Christiania. Politicians are pressured by developers, salivating at the potential profits of developing this once nearly worthless land. There's talk about opening the commune to market forces and developing posh apartments to replace existing residences. Increasingly, this community of peaceniks is in danger of being evicted. But Christiania has a legal team, and litigation will likely drag on for many years. Many predict that Christiania will withstand the government's challenge as it has in years past. The community, which also calls itself Freetown, fended off a similar attempt in 1976 with the help of fervent supporters from around Europe. Bevar Christiania, or Save Christiania, banners fly everywhere, and locals are confident that their free way of life will survive. As history has shown, the challenge may just make this hippie haven a bit stronger. As I left Christiania and headed back into clean, orderly, and conformist Denmark, I looked up at the back of the Welcome to Christiania sign. It read, "You are entering the European Union." Later that day, on a bustling street in downtown Copenhagen, I paused to watch a parade of ragtag soldiers against conformity, dressed in black and waving Save Christiania banners. They walked sadly behind a World War II vintage truck blasting Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall. I had never really listened to the words before, but the anthem of self-imposed isolation and revolt against conformity seemed to perfectly fit the determination of Christianians to stand up against corporatism, against thought control, and against stifled individuality. On their banner, a slogan painted onto an old bedsheet read in Danish, "Live life artistically. Only dead fish follow the current." Those marching flew the Christiania flag, three yellow dots on an orange background. They say the dots are from the O's in love, love, love. While I wouldn't choose to live in Christiania, I'd feel a loss if it were shut down. There's something unfortunately brutal about a world that makes the little Christianias, independent bookstores, family farms, nomadic communities, and so on, fight aggressive giants such as developers, big chains, agribusiness, and centralized government to the death. Those economic and governmental behemoths always seem to win. And when corporatism wins, we may become safer and wealthier and even more comfortable, but it all comes at a cost. The need for a Christiania is not limited to the Danes. After that trip from the comfort of my suburban Seattle living room, I stumbled upon live TV coverage of the finale of the Burning Man Festival. Watching that annual Labor Day massing of America's artistic free spirits in the Nevada desert, I heard the cry of an American fringe community that, much like the tribe at Christiania, wants to be free in an increasingly interconnected world that demands conformity. Traveling in Denmark, considering well-ordered Danish socialism and reflecting on the free-spirited ideals and struggles of Christiania, gives me insight into parts of my own society that refuse to be just another brick in the wall. Hopefully, when the pressures of conformity require selling a bit of our soul, travel experiences like these help us understand the potential loss before it's regrettably gone. Denmark is a riddle that I love puzzling over. On the one hand, their dedication to their social contract is the bedrock of their insistent happiness. On the other, in their long-standing acceptance of Christiania, the Danes seem to be unusually tolerant of free spirits. I imagine that the dramatic tension between these extremes is part of what keeps Danish life so interesting, for both the Danes and for us visitors. As all societies vie to win that most content survey, traveling reminds us that contentment is based not on surrendering to conformity, but in finding that balance between working well together and letting creative spirits run free. Chapter 6, Turkey and Morocco, Sampling Secular Islam. My dad used to be absolutely distraught by the notion that God and Allah could be the same. Years ago, I couldn't resist teaching my toddler Andy to hold out his arms, bob them up and down, and say Allah, Allah, Allah after table grace just to freak out his grandpa. Later, rather than torture my dad, I took a more loving and certainly more effective approach to opening him up to the Muslim world. I took him to Turkey. Now, while he's still afraid of ISIS, my dad is no longer afraid of Islam. While violent Islamic fundamentalists represent a tiny fraction of all Muslims, the threats they pose are real, and they get plenty of media coverage. To help balance my understanding of Islam, I make a point to travel and learn about its reasonable mainstream side, where embracing secularism is not seen as being anti-Muslim, but simply the mark of a modern democracy. Two of my favorite destinations for doing that have been Turkey and Morocco. Visiting moderate developing nations that happen to be primarily Muslim provides a safe and fascinating look at our globe's fastest growing religion, practiced by more than 1.5 billion people worldwide. Through travel, we can observe Islamic societies struggling, like our own society, with how to navigate a rough and tumble globalized world. In doing so, we gain empathy. I have long considered Turkey, one of my favorite countries, an ideal classroom for better understanding our world and its struggles. My company has offered tours of Turkey through good times and bad since before the first Gulf War in 1990. We've followed Turkey's torrid modernization, its battles with separatist Kurds, and its internal tug-of-war between modern urban secularists and fundamentalists. And for many years, I've worried with my Turkish friends about the persistent rise of Islamic fundamentalism in a country that has always taken such pride in the modern secularism of its beloved founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Today, Turkey, like Europe and the United States, faces a rising tide of populism, nativism, and nationalism. But in Turkey, this trend is especially extreme and especially troubling. Turkey's president since 2014, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has embraced law-and-order fear-mongering as an excuse to cut down on personal freedom and bulk up his military. He's incrementally dismantling the safeguards that have kept Turkey secular and moderate for nearly a century. Today's Turkey is at a crossroads, deciding what kind of country it wants to be going forward. For many years, the predictable question I'd get from loved ones was, why are you going to Turkey? With each visit to Istanbul, one of my favorite cities in the world, all I could think was, why would anyone not travel here? Now, with the relative darkness of Erdogan settling over 80 million Turks, Western tourism is slow in a country where it once thrived. Hotels are suffering. Squares that thrived with guests from around the world are quiet. And tour groups from the West are rare. From a safety point of view, I'd pack my bags for a trip to Istanbul tomorrow, confident that I'd receive a warm welcome. But I'd be a little sad, as the free spirit I expect to find in Turkey would be hiding behind building-size Erdogan banners. This chapter is, I'll admit, largely nostalgic, reflecting on a happier and simpler time in pre-Erdogan Turkey. But the lessons are as true as ever, and hopefully, when the spirit of Atatürk retakes its place as the guiding light of the Turkish people, we'll be traveling there again soon. I'll also take you on a brief visit to Morocco, another gateway to the Muslim world. In general, I hope this chapter inspires you to travel boldly into Islam, because the experiences you enjoy there come with lessons you'll draw upon for the rest of your life. President Erdogan versus a pluralistic Turkey. Turkey is not exactly living in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. It shares borders with Syria, Iraq, and Iran. 10% of its society is Kurdish, many of whom have aspirations to secede and form an independent Kurdistan. In the mid-2010s, 2 million Syrian refugees fleeing their war-torn homeland flowed through Turkey, many on their way to Europe. And, as the easternmost member of NATO, Turkey finds itself caught in the middle of growing tension between the United States and Russia. Because of its unique position, I've long considered Turkey a model for balancing the needs of a strong leader with Western ideals of pluralism and secularism. For years, Muslims in neighboring countries who dreamed of a more democratic system looked to Turkey for inspiration. But after Recep Tayyip Erdogan was elected president in 2014, it gradually became clear that he had a different vision: to make Turkey less free, less Western-oriented, and less secular. When Atatürk founded modern Turkey in 1923, he anticipated such a leader. In fact, Turkey's constitution calls for a strict separation of mosque and state, and even requires the Turkish military to overthrow its own president if ever he violates that tenet, which they've actually had to do on several occasions. President Erdogan needed an excuse to shore up his power, and he got it on July 15, 2016. On that night, a faction of Turkey's military attempted a coup, ostensibly to stop Erdogan's overreach. It failed, and Erdogan responded with a harsh crackdown. Erdogan declared an extended state of emergency, replacing leading generals, silencing professors, shutting down the press, and locking up thousands of Western-minded Turks. He essentially criminalized his political opposition. Before the coup attempt, Erdogan, who was then focused on getting Turkey admitted to the EU, had been praised for his support of religious freedoms and civil rights. Suddenly, things changed. The leaders of the military were replaced by Erdogan cronies. The military and the judiciary, both counted on for their defense of secularism, were effectively muzzled. Erdogan moved to stop the public from organizing. He blocked or limited internet access and social media. Turks were arrested on charges of simply insulting the president. Erdogan, named by the publication called The European Voice European of the Year in 2004, had now moved Turkey, its populace thoroughly frightened and submissive, closer to autocracy. Joining the EU is no longer a Turkish priority. Instead, Erdogan is cozying up to Russia and, like Putin, uses any conflict with the West as a way to boost his popularity and empower him to make more fundamental changes in Turkish society. Erdogan further consolidated his power in April of 2017 when a narrowly passed referendum increased the president's reach and effectively neutered the checks and balances among the various branches of Turkish government. This scares moderate and progressive Turks because it legitimizes Erdogan's hold on power as the will of the people. And observers of history see recent events in Turkey lining up with a frightening pattern that allows autocrats to take control of a democratic state. First comes a flashy crisis, the failed coup, which sets the stage for a strongman to legally amplify his power, the referendum. The result? A police state with a silenced opposition. I find Erdogan fascinating as an example of the impact that a single individual can have on history. It feels good to celebrate the power of grassroots activism to bring change. But sadly, history and travel both teach us that one person, put into power by a quirky election, an assassination, or a convenient excuse to throw out a constitution, can derail an entire democratic society. Istanbul Deja Vu. When I was in my 20s, I finished 8 European trips in a row in Turkey. I didn't plan it that way. It was the natural finale, the subconscious cherry on top of every year's travel adventures. In recent trips to the city where East meets West, I've been struck both by the similarities and by the jarring differences between the city I knew back in the 1980s and the one I've enjoyed in recent years. My memories of those trips are filled with both nostalgia and vivid examples of how gradual and positive change was sweeping our planet. It was 2015, and I was excited to reacquaint myself with Turkey. The moment I stepped off my plane, I remembered how much I've always enjoyed this country. Marveling at the efficiency of Istanbul's Atatürk Airport, I popped onto the street and into a yellow taxi. Seeing the welcoming grin of the unshaven driver who greeted me with a merhaba, I just blurted out, "Çok güzel." I forgot I remembered the phrase. It just came out of me like a baby shouts for joy. I was back in Turkey, and it was very beautiful indeed. Çok güzel. My first hours in Turkey were filled with similar deja vu moments like no travel homecoming I could remember. As the taxi turned off the highway and into the tangled lanes of the Old Town tourist zone just below the Blue Mosque, all the tourist-friendly businesses were still lined up, providing a backdrop for the chorus line of barkers shouting, "Yes, mister, a good deal today for you." I looked at the kids in the streets and remembered a rougher time when kids like these would earn small change by hanging out the passenger door of ramshackle vans. They'd yell, "Top copy, top copy, top copy," or whichever neighborhood was the destination, in a scramble to pick up passengers in the shared minibuses called dolmuş. The dolmuş, a wild cross between a taxi and a bus, is literally and so appropriately called stuffed, or dolmuş. While Turkey's new affluence has nearly killed the dolmuş, the echoes of the boys hollering from the vans bounced happily in my memory. "Aksaray, Aksaray, Aksaray, Sultanahmet, Sultanahmet, Sultanahmet." I remembered my favorite call was for the train station's neighborhood. "Serkeci, Serkeci, Serkeci." After dropping off my bag at my hotel, I stopped for tea, served in the customary small tulip-shaped glass before heading out to explore. Istanbul, a city of over 10 million, was thriving. The city was poignantly littered, both with remnants of grand, if eventually corrupt, empires, and with living, breathing reminders of the harsh reality of life in the developing world. Sipping my tea, I watched old men shuffle by, hunched over, as if still bent under the towering loads they had carried all of their human beast of burden lives. And yet, this ancient city was striding into the future. During my visit, Everyone was buzzing about the new tunnel under the Bosporus, giving a million commuters in the Asian suburbs of Istanbul an easy train link to their places of work in Europe. The tunnel was emblematic of modern Turkey's commitment to connecting East and West, just as Istanbul bridges Asia and Europe. I also saw it as a concrete example of how parts of the developing world are emerging as economic dynamos. Stepping out of my shoes, I entered the vast turquoise, and therefore not quite rightly named, Blue Mosque. Hoping for another déjà vu, I didn't get it. Something was missing. Yes, gone was the smell of countless sweaty socks, knees, palms, and foreheads soaked into the ancient carpet upon which Muslim worshippers did their quite physical prayer workouts. Sure enough, the Blue Mosque had a fresh new carpet, with a subtle design that keeps worshippers organized in rows, the same way that lined paper tames printed letters. The prayer service led out, and a sea of Turks surged for the door. Being caught up in a crush of locals, where the only way to get any personal space is to look up, is a connecting with humanity ritual for me in my travels. I seek out these opportunities. It's the closest I'll ever come to experiencing the exhilaration of body surfing above a mosh pit. Going outside with the worshipping flow, I scanned the dark sky. That scene, one I'd forgotten was so breathtaking, played for me again. Hard-pumping seagulls powering through the humid air in a black sky, surging into the light as they crossed in front of floodlit minarets. Walking down to the Golden Horn Inlet and Istanbul's churning waterfront, I crossed the new Galata Bridge, which made me miss the dismantled and shipped-out old Galata Bridge, so crusty with life's struggles. Feeling a wistful nostalgia, I thought of how all societies morph with the push and pull of the times. But then I realized that while the old bridge is gone, the new one has been engulfed with the same vibrant street life, boys casting their lines, old men sucking on water pipes, and sesame seed bread rings filling steamy glass-windowed carts. Strolling the new Galata Bridge and still finding old scenes reminded me how stubborn cultural inertia can be. If you give a camel-riding Bedouin a new Mercedes, he still decorates it like a camel. I remember looking at tribal leaders in Afghanistan, shaven, cleaned up, and given a bureaucrat's uniform. But looking more closely, I could still see the bushy, gray-bearded men in dusty old robes still living behind those modern uniforms. On a trip to Kathmandu, I recall seeing a Californian who'd dropped out of the modern rat race. Calloused, almost animal feet, matted dreadlocks draped in sackcloth as he stood cane in hand before the living virgin goddess. Somehow, I could still see Los Angeles in his eyes. The resilience of a culture can't be overcome with a haircut and a shave, or lack of one, or a new bridge. On the sloppy adjacent harbor front, the venerable fish and bread boats were still rocking in the constant chop of the busy harbor. In a humbler day, they were 20-foot-long open dinghies, rough boats with battered car tires for fenders, with open fires for grilling fish. For a few coins, the fishermen would bury a big white fillet in a hunk of fluffy white bread, wrap it in newsprint, and I was on my way, dining out on fish in Istanbul. In recent years, the fish and bread boats had been shut down. They had no license. After a popular uproar, they came back. They're a bit more hygienic, no longer using newspaper for wrappings, but still rocking in the waves and slamming out fresh fish. In Turkey, I have more personal rituals than in other countries. I cap my day with a bowl of sütlaç, that's rice pudding with a sprinkle of cinnamon, still served in a square and shiny stainless steel bowl with a matching spoon not much bigger than a gelato sampler. And I don't let a day go by in Turkey without enjoying a tea-house game of backgammon with a stranger. Boards have become less characteristic. They're now cheap and mass-produced, almost disposable. And today's dice, plastic and perfect, make me miss the tiny handmade bones of the 20th century with their disobedient dots. But some things never change. To test a fun cultural quirk, I tossed my dice and paused. As I remembered, a bystander stepped right up and moved for me. When it comes to backgammon, there's just one right way, and everybody knows it. And in Turkey, as if a result of its ruthless history, when starting a new game, the winner goes first. With each backgammon game, I think of one of my most precious possessions back home, an old-time hand-hewn inlaid backgammon board, with rusty little hinges held in place by hasty tacks, and beautiful inlaid wood, the soft white wood worn deeper than the harder dark wood. 20 years after taking that backgammon board home as a souvenir, I open it and still smell the tobacco, tea, and soul of a traditional Turkish community. There's almost nothing in my world that's worn or has been enjoyed long enough to absorb the smells of my life and community. It's a reminder to me of the cost of modernity. And when the feel and smell of my old backgammon board takes me back to Turkey, I'm reminded how in the face of all our modernity, the resilient charm of traditional cultures is endangered and worth preserving. With that visit, I observed how the people, like those dots on the modern dice, line up better these days. The weave of a mosque carpet provides direction. There's a seat for everyone, as the dolmuş is no longer so stuffed. Fez sales to tourists are way down, but scarfwear by local women, a symbol of traditional Muslim identity, is way up. Each of my deja vu moments shows a society confronting powerful forces of change, while also wanting to stay the same. My hotel's inviting terrace was open at night, ideal for gazing past floodlit husks of forts and walls out at the sleepy Bosporus, with Asia lurking just across the inky straits. The strategic waterway was speckled with the lights of freighters at anchor, stretching far into the distance. Noticing the power of the moonlight shimmering on the water, I recalled the legend of the Turkish flag, a white star and crescent moon reflected in a pool of bright red blood after a great and victorious battle. From my perch, it seemed that now the crescent moon shone over not blood, but money. Trade and shipping, modern-day battles in the arena of capitalism. At breakfast, the same view was lively and already bright enough to make me wish I had sunglasses. An empty oil tanker heading north for a Romanian fill-up was light and riding high. Its prow cut through the water like a plow, a reminder of how today trade is sustenance and oil is a treasured crop. As I scanned the city, it occurred to me that Istanbul is physically not that different from my hometown. I could replace the skyline of domed mosques and minarets with churches and steeples, and it could be the rough end of any port city, USA. Rather than my standard bowl of cereal for my Turkish breakfasts, I go local. Olives, goat cheese, cucumbers, tomatoes, bread, and a horrible instant orange drink masquerading as juice. Gazing at my plate, I studied the olive oil. Ignoring the three olive pits, I saw tiny, mysterious flakes of spices. They were doing a silent and slow-motion do-si-do to a distant rhythm, with lyrics that told of arduous camel caravan rides along the fabled Silk Road from China. Later that day, I took an aimless stroll, as I love to do here, to immerse myself in Turkey, collecting random memories. Wandering under stiletto minarets, I listened as a hard-working loudspeaker, lashed to the minaret as if a religious crow's nest, belted out a call to prayer. Noticing the twinkling lights strung up in honor of the holy month of Ramadan, I thought, charming, they've draped Christmas lights between the minarets. But a Turk might come to my house and say, charming, he's draped Ramadan lights on his Christmas tree. I marveled at the multi-generational conviviality at the Hippodrome, that long oblong plaza still shaped like the chariot racecourse it was 18 centuries ago. Precocious children high-fived me as they tried out their only English phrase, what is your name? Just to enjoy their quizzical look, I'd say, 7 o'clock. As I struggled to understand their society, I guess my mischievous streak wanted them to deal with a little of the intercultural confusion I was dealing with. It's in this environment that, as a tour guide, I spent many trips introducing tour members, like my father, to Turkish culture and Islam. I recall well-educated American travelers struggling to get things straight. People would quiz me, so where did they get the name Quran for their Bible? Could it be considered a Bible? Turkish guides love to tell stories of tourists who ask, was this church built before or after Christ? But all guides repeat to themselves that first rule of guiding, there are no stupid questions. After all, it's in environments like Istanbul, in countries all around the world, that thoughtful travelers get out of their comfort zones and enjoy the easy educational rewards that come with being steep on the learning curve. Turkish Village Insights in Gözlerjurt. Big cities can be relatively cosmopolitan and homogenized by modern affluence. But small towns with their more change-averse residents are like cultural humidors, keeping fragile traditions moist and full of local flavor. Gözlerjurt, an obscure to the world but proud of itself village in central Turkey, has long taught me the richness and nobility of rustic village life in the developing world. Students of the world find that in any country, remote towns and villages can be wonderful classrooms. On my last visit, Gözlerjurt was all decked out. I happened to arrive on the day of everybody's favorite festival, a circumcision party. It's a wonderful celebration. Turks call it a wedding without the in-laws. The little boy, dressed like a prince, rode tall on his decorated donkey through a commotion of friends and relatives to the house where a doctor was sharpening his knife. Even with paper money pinned to his fancy outfit and loved ones chanting calming spiritual music, the boy looked frightened. But the ritual snipping went off without a glitch, and a good time was had, at least by everyone else. On a different trip, I learned that Turkish weddings are also quite a spectacle. I'll never forget being a special guest at a wedding in Gözlerjurt. The entire community gathered. Calling the party to order, the oldest couple looked happily at the young bride and groom and shared a local blessing. May you grow old together on one pillow. Whenever there's a family festival, village Turks turn on the music and dance. Everyone swept onto their feet, including visiting tourists. It's easy. Just follow the locals as they hold out their arms, snap their fingers, and shake their shoulders. During one such Gözlerjurt party, the man of the house came over to me, the foreigner, and wanted to impress me. Waving me to a quiet corner, he said, "Here on my wall, the most sacred place in my home, is my Quran bag where I keep my Quran. And in my Quran bag, I also keep a copy of the Bible and a copy of the Torah. Because I believe that we Muslims, Christians, and Jews are all people of the book, children of the same God." Leaving the party, I walked down the street. The town seemed cluttered with ugly, unfinished concrete buildings bristling with rusty reinforcement bars. While I love the Turks, I couldn't help but think, why can't these people get their act together and just finish these buildings? That was before I learned that in Turkey, there's an ethic among parents, even poor ones, that you leave your children with a house. Historically, Turks are reluctant to store money in the bank because it disappears through inflation. So instead, they invest bit by bit by constructing a building. Every time they get $100 together, they put it into that ever-growing house. They leave the rebar exposed until they have another $100 so they can make another wall, put on a window, frame in another door, and add more rebar. Now, when I look at the rusty rebar, I remember that Turks say, rebar holds the family together, and it becomes much prettier. At the edge of Gözlerjurt, I came upon a little boy playing a flute. Just like in biblical times, it was carved out of an eagle bone. I listened, and I heard another eagle bone flute out of sight coming from over the hill where his dad was tending the sheep. As they have for centuries, the boy stays with the mom and plays the eagle bone flute. The dad tends the flock and plays his flute too, so the entire family knows all is well. I hiked up the Shepherd's Hill and sat overlooking the town. On a higher hill, just beyond the simple tin roof of its mosque, I saw the letters Gözlerjurt spelled out in white rocks. Listening to the timeless sounds of the community, I thought how there are countless Gözlerjurts scattered across every country on earth, from here in Turkey to the United States of America. Each is humble, yet filled with rich traditions, proud people, and its own village-centric view of the world. Gözlerjurt means beautiful land. While few visitors would consider it particularly beautiful, that's how the people who call it home see it. They'd live nowhere else. And for them, it truly is Gözlerjurt. Defending the separation of mosque and state, for now. When visiting eastern Turkey, you don't have a list of sites. It's a cultural scavenger hunt. Years ago, I was exploring with a tour group when we came across 300 kids in a stadium. They were thrusting their fists into the air and screaming in unison, "We are a secular nation. We are a secular nation." I asked my local guide, "What's going on? Don't they like God?" She said, "Yes, we love God here in Turkey, but considering the rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism just over the border in Iran, we're very concerned about the fragile and precious separation of mosque and state in our country." And these students are having a pep rally for secularism. Turkey has long modeled how a nation can be both Muslim and secular. But in recent years, with the rise of President Erdogan, the line between mosque and state gets a little more blurred. Turkey, like so much of today's world, is in a tug-of-war between secular forces and fundamentalism. And, just as in other Islamic lands, Turkish fundamentalist groups use fear of perceived American meddling to win public support. With the ramped-up economic metabolism and change that comes with globalization, people whose time-honored ways are threatened cling to what makes their cultures and societies unique. They seek solace in their rituals, religion, and tradition. Considering the widespread impact of globalization, I believe this dynamic is at work in all countries, rich and poor, east and west, including my own. During the holy month of Ramadan, practicing Muslims refrain from eating, drinking, or even smoking during daylight hours. As a visitor, I find the Muslim faith all the more vivid and engaging during Ramadan. As an oblivious tourist, I kept stumbling into subtle ways Ramadan affects everyday life. Sucking sweet apple tobacco from a water pipe, I offered my waiter a puff of my hookah. He put his hand over his heart and explained he'd love to, but he couldn't until the sun went down. During Ramadan, if you sleep lightly, you'll wake to the call of prayer and the sounds of a convivial meal just before dawn. As the sun rises, the fast begins. Later, as the sun sets, the food comes out and the nightly festival begins. Saying, "May God accept our fast today," the staff at my restaurant, where I was having only a glass of tea, welcomed me to photograph them and then offered to share their meal. Anywhere in Islam, witnessing the breaking of the day-long Ramadan fast at sundown is like watching children waiting for the recess bell. Throughout my visit, every time I witnessed this ritual, people offered to share their food. At that restaurant, I said, "No thanks," but they set me up anyway with figs, lentil soup, bread, and baklava. As much as I enjoy these Ramadan experiences, my recent visits left me with an uneasy awareness of how fundamentalism is creeping into the mainstream. Mayors now play a part in organizing Ramadan festivities. During Ramadan, no-name neighborhood mosques literally overflow during prayer time. With carpets unfurled on sidewalks, it's a struggle just walking down the street. I got the unsettling feeling that the inconvenience to passing pedestrians wasn't their concern, as if they felt everyone should be praying rather than trying to get somewhere. I don't want to overstate Turkey's move to the right, but keen and caring secular observers see an ominous trend. I have friends in Turkey distraught at their country's slide toward fundamentalism. To them, it's an evolution that seems difficult to stop. Imagine watching your country gradually slip into a theocracy. One universal interpretation of scripture, prayer in school, religious dress codes, women covering up and accepting a scripturally ordained subservient role to men, judges chosen on the basis of the dominant religion, laws and textbooks being rewritten. Whether abroad or in the United States, when the separation of religion and state is violated, a moralistic ruling class that believes they are right and others are wrong is set free to reshape its society. Seeing this struggle play out in Turkey, a land that first adopted a modern secular constitution only in 1924, is dramatic. I can feel the chill sweep across a tea house when a fundamentalist Muslim man walks by, followed a few steps behind by his covered-up wife. For a traveler, the move to the religious right is easiest to see in people's clothing. As the father of a teenage girl who did her best to dress trendier than her parents allowed, I'm intrigued by teenage Muslim girls covering up under scarves and, I imagine, under duress. Sure, they're covered from head to toe, but under their modest robe, many wear chic clothes and high heels. Throughout Islam, scarves are widely used both as tools for modesty and as fashion.